From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. That was Democratic presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State. After the results of Super Tuesday were announced, she and Bernie Sanders split the 12 states that held primaries or caucuses on Tuesday. Sanders was also hopeful after winning four states and a virtual tie in Massachusetts.
Thank you. It is good. This campaign, as I think all of you know, this campaign is not just about electing a president, it is about transforming America. It is about making our great country the nation that we know it has the potential to be. It is about dealing with some unpleasant truths that exist in America today and having the guts to confront those truths.
Clinton and Sanders each won their home states. Clinton with 66% in Arkansas, down from her 73% in 2008, while Sanders soared in his home state of Vermont with 87% of the vote. Sanders won two states that Obama won in 2008, Colorado with 59% and Minnesota with 62%. And in Oklahoma, a state where Clinton beat Obama in 2008, Sanders won with 52%. Clinton won two states that she lost to Obama in 2008, both of those in the South, Alabama and Georgia. And in Massachusetts, a state she won in 2008 with 56% of the vote, as of early Wednesday, she held a slight lead over Sanders, about 20,000 out of about 1.2 million votes. Looking back on Super Tuesday, we spoke first with political analyst Eric Dratzer. Not exactly a trouncing whatsoever.
No, I wouldn't say that it was a trouncing, though. I don't know how much stock we can really put into Sanders, getting a landslide victory in Vermont, nor how much stock we should put into Hillary winning in Arkansas. I don't think that either of these are particularly significant. Right. Both of those states are pretty obvious as far as where they'll go in the general election. Obviously, Arkansas being solidly red and Vermont being solidly blue. So what I do think is interesting, though, yes, I agree with you, Sanders was not trounced. However, again, we're hearing reports of voting irregularities in Georgia. We're hearing reports of irregularities in a number of states. And this is, quite frankly, and I know that my progressive friends don't like it when I bring this up, but this is, again, I think, an example of cowardice on the part of Bernie Sanders. He did not challenge, either legally or in the form of public relations, Hillary Clinton and the irregularities in Iowa with that ridiculous nonsense of the coin tosses. He did not challenge the reports of irregularities in Nevada, which was an extremely close contest. And so, again, I think that while Sanders had somewhat of a decent showing in a number of states, he doesn't seem to have the fire that is necessary to really take on the Clinton machine. And this is really, I think, the crux of the problem for Sanders is essentially that he is running a very weak campaign against against a very dirty opponent. And I'm not sure that that is a winning strategy. I'm not sure that that's a well thought out strategy. And I think that he's paying a very real price for that. There are a number of states that I think could have been up for grabs for Bernie had he really challenged. For instance, if we were to take, for example, if Bernie would have challenged and ultimately won in Iowa, then carried that momentum towards his obvious victory in New Hampshire and would have moved that forward into Nevada, that would have been the kind of momentum that could have permanently sunk Hillary Clinton and propelled Bernie Sanders towards the nomination against the wishes of the Democratic Party establishment. He didn't do that. He's forced himself into a secondary position, into a more or less a receiver kind of position rather than an aggressor. A defensive posture is really what he struck, and that's not going to win. And unfortunately, as I said, he's up against a very well-oiled political machine, one that has been in place essentially for 24 years, if not a little bit longer than that. And so the fact of the matter is, as we saw with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, as we've seen with some of the other cornerstones of the Democratic Party establishment, they are arrayed against Sanders. And until he's willing to pull out all the stops, they are going to continue crushing him.
You know, if Sanders really ran on his issues, not just, positing them in debates, but really targeting those issues, and in particular, started to address the fact that everything that he says he would like to see implemented, universal health care, jobs, all of this, are going to require cutting a big chunk of the military out and reorienting our foreign policy. Why is he not doing that? Because he would win.
Well, I, look, there's a part of me that wants to chalk that up to weakness, to a certain level of cowardice, in fear that he could be pilloried as, you know, anti-military and so forth, as if that's such a bad thing. On the other hand, I also think that there is an ideological component here. Sanders has relatively hawkish positions when it comes to foreign policy, and this is something that Sanders supporters don't like to note publicly, but it's true. Sanders, aside from opposing the Iraq war, which was Bush's war, which a number of Democrats opposed for political reasons, I would say more political rather than humanitarian, or peace-related reasons. But aside from that, Sanders has pretty much been on board with most of U.S. wars of the time that he's been in office. And I don't really necessarily think that he believes that the United States should really pull back militarily, at least in a significant way. Now, he may sort of present himself as if he's of that opinion, but his record does not show that. Aside from support for the criminal war against Serbia, the bombing of Serbia, he's lent his support to the Afghanistan war. He's lent his support to the war on Libya. He has taken very, very hawkish positions vis-a-vis Syria. So, on the one hand, Sanders obviously should be taking that position, but I'm not sure that's really reflective of his ideas and of his policies. And that's obviously one of the major blind spots that Sanders has. And one of the reasons somebody like me can't outwardly support Sanders is because, quite frankly, Sanders has not distanced himself from the military-industrial complex. He has not pledged to significantly reduce the military in a substantive way, not just reducing its budget, but literally closing bases, literally pulling troops out of the 100-plus countries that they are in, actually taking a substantive stand against the empire. Until he does that, he's not going to have the support of people like me and many others like me for whom that issue, the issue of foreign policy and U.S. military aggression, is in many ways the central issue.
What do you see coming in the Democratic primary next?
Well, I think that further consolidation of gains for Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton's machine is obviously working pretty well. Although there was the defection of Tulsi Gabbard, the vice chair of the DNC, I don't see the Democratic Party really changing significantly. Quite frankly, according to the data that we're looking at and according to the results of Super Tuesday, while Bernie did win a little bit and Bernie does have a little bit of momentum, this is still Clinton's race to lose. And I think Clinton is more more concerned about legal issues and scandals than she is about Bernie Sanders.
Do you think if one of those legal problems or scandals comes to the fore sooner rather than later, that this could put Sanders over the top?
Well, one could hope. Obviously, anything that derails Clinton is a good thing for people interested in peace and a good thing for anybody who considers themselves a progressive. If you're asking me, you know, if we're in Vegas where I'm putting my money, I'm putting my money on no indictment. I'm putting my money on Hillary Clinton winning the nomination and the disaster of disasters, a Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump general election in which no matter which way it goes, we all lose.
Yeah. On that score, what do you see after Super Tuesday going on in the Republican Party?
Well, Donald Trump stomped his opponents. I mean, it's pretty clear. Marco Rubio tried to spin this as a win for his camp, which is ridiculous. I guess the news of this morning is that he did win the caucus in Minnesota, from what I read. I don't know if that's going to change or not. But other than that, Rubio is, I mean, I don't want to necessarily employ Trump's rhetoric for anything other than humor, but he's a lightweight. He's a loser. And the fact of the matter is, Rubio is not the candidate that's going to defeat Trump. Neither is Ted Cruz. Trump is what I've described as the guest you invite for dinner and turn around and see that he's let your house on fire. That is what Trump has done. And now the Republican Party are trying to scramble to derail Trump and to reassert some kind of control from the establishment, from the center of the Republican Party. And it's much too far gone for that. Trump is going to get this nomination. I think that that is clear. I was dead wrong about Trump's prospects 6 months ago. I'm perfectly happy to say it. I didn't think Trump was a serious candidate. He obviously is now. The snowball has gotten to the point where it is now an avalanche and it cannot be stopped. That is ultimately where this is going. The question for me at this point now is what kind of a running mate Trump is going to choose. If his campaign is stupid and short-sighted, then he'll get somebody like a Christie. That's obviously what Christie wants is posturing for. But if his campaign is smart, they will target a woman, if possible, an African-American or Hispanic woman, preferably, to insulate him from the obvious charges of sexism and misogyny, which will come from Hillary Clinton's camp, and also to insulate him from charges of racism and xenophobia. Somebody like Christina Martinez in New Mexico, the chair of the Republican Governors Association, the female Hispanic governor of a border state, somebody like that would be an ideal running mate for Trump. And there's probably a number of others that he could select from. That is, I think, the burning question on the Republican side, because ultimately, as I said, this is going to be a Trump Clinton general election. And again, I mean, when you're choosing, it's do you want the hemlock or do you want the guillotine?
Right. Eric Traitson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Professor Anthony Montero, formerly of Temple University, lifelong activist and political commentator, spoke with us from Philadelphia about the results of Super Tuesday.
I think if we look at Super Tuesday in realistic terms, Sanders has momentum. It was expected that Clinton would do very well in the southern states, where the Democrats will not win in the general election anyway, and where politics have not recovered from the defeat of Reconstruction after the 1870s. And so therefore, you have a very distorted and controlled form of politics, especially among black folk in the Deep South. But what we do see, Clinton is getting these large numbers in very, very disturbingly low turnout. For example, in South Carolina, it's estimated that the Democratic Party turnout was about 13%. Most people and most black voters, and more specifically, the demographic young black voters that Bernie is appealing to, were probably almost non-existent in the South Carolina primary. And I'm certain that's the case in Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama and other southern states. So I'm not conceding the primary election to Clinton. I think if we look closely at things, you know, Sanders and Clinton tied in the Iowa caucuses. In Massachusetts, it was a virtual tie. And if one factors in the fact that that the Clinton machine probably stole a number of votes in Massachusetts, and then he won Oklahoma and Colorado. I think Sanders has some momentum if he can inspire his constituents, young people, disaffected Republicans and Democrats and independents in states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and so on. The states that the Democrats must win. So on the Democratic side, I think it's still a race. I think on the Republican side, the Trump phenomenon, and it is a phenomenon, and it's very difficult to define it from the standpoint of the traditional conservative Republican Party. I think it's a clearer path to victory for Trump among Republicans than for Clinton among Democrats. And I think this has significance going forward to the general election. It would seem to me that given the fact that the Trump voters are not just Republicans or not just what are called evangelical Republicans, but are Democrats who are voting for him in Republican primaries, and independents who are also registering Republican to vote for Trump, which means that going forward, he has a movement of considerable breadth and depth, far deeper than the Clinton would have. So I think the Democrats have to think about how to challenge Trump. And I would think that it would have to be a insurgent movement from the more or left center left going up against an insurgent movement from the center right. And I would argue that in terms of winning in November, Sanders and the Sanders movement has the best chance of defeating the movement that is represented by Trump.
And, you know, the polls support that in the, you know, head-to-head matchups. Sanders does much better against Trump, beats him pretty commandingly than Clinton does.
Yes.
You know, and you mentioned that it's hard to characterize Trump, this Trump thing, the phenomenon, because it's not even just a political phenomenon. It's a larger, like, sociological phenomenon. And
I agree with that.
And there's an interesting contradiction that it creates, because the Republican establishment, supposedly, that's what the dope is on the street, does not want Trump as a candidate, and he's not winning enough delegates so far to win on the first ballot. So if they end up with a brokered convention and hand it to one of the party guys, the Republican normal prime voters are going to be confronted with sit on our hands in protest and allow a socialist to be elected if Sanders is the candidate.
Well, I agree with you, but I would say this. The trajectory within the Republican Party seems to be favoring Trump. He has all the momentum. I think he won 8 of the primaries on Super Tuesday. I don't know what these people are talking about challenging him and and so on. I think he is the heads-on favorite. But I think that with Sanders, you have the possibility of winning because it's not just a normal election. You have a movement from the center left contesting a movement from the center right. Mm-hmm. And each candidate represents in different political form deep discontentment among the masses of people. In fact, I think each of them represents the fact that we are in a legitimacy crisis where the government and the politicians, traditional politicians, are not being seen as legitimate by millions, hundreds of millions of people in this country.
Mm. So let's take some hypotheticals. First, a Sanders versus Trump campaign. How do you think that plays out?
You said a Sanders versus who?
Trump. Donald Trump.
Well, I wouldn't predict who would win. I think because Sanders brings all of these new voters into the process, his chances are better. He expands the electorate. Clinton narrows the electorate. In fact, if Clinton is the Democratic Party candidate, people will not vote. Where you have a Clinton against a Trump, Trump brings new voters into the process and therefore expands the electorate. But the other thing is that Trump, but again, it's mainly white voters at this time. Trump brings into his movement Democrats, Republicans, and independents. Hillary doesn't bring anything new into the electoral process. Bernie brings new people into the electoral process. So I'm looking at it from the standpoint of two distinct movements of the disaffected, the Sanders movement and the Trump movement, facing off against each other, and perhaps the largest turnout in a presidential election in decades.
Now, you and I would both like to see that, with the movements being expressed and more participation from the electorate. Suppose the party chiefs on each side are successful and you end up with Clinton versus Cruz or Clinton versus Rubio. How do you think the electorate will respond, and what do we have to do in those circumstances?
Well, I think in a case like that, the forces of discontent, the forces that are alienated from the political parties and the politicians, will find other ways to protest. In other words, rather than the movements expressing themselves in this year through the electoral process, they will leave the electoral process after the Cleveland and Philadelphia conventions and become protest movements against both parties. This could perhaps lead to the formation of third and fourth parties with mass bases.
What do you think about the possibility of third parties under that scenario seeing a swell in their ranks?
Well, I think that's possible. I don't know how Jill Stein and the Green Party are positioned, but certainly she could benefit from this. But I think the disaffected, if they decide collectively to stay within electoral politics, the possibility of the formation of third and fourth parties is very high. But that doesn't mean that they have to choose the electoral path at all. They could choose the path of protest, mass civil disobedience, shutting down the economy, strikes, rebuilding of unions, rebuilding of what they call civil society, and so on and so forth. The options are multiple in terms of what the masses can do. I would argue that the electoral path is the least productive for the people. But nonetheless, it's there. It has to be explored. People are in it. And so they'll do what they have to do. But if they are locked out at the conventions, or if they are swindled and cheated of the votes and the delegates that they think they should have, then they're going to go the route of civil disobedience, of protest, of organization at the grassroots, of shutting the system down, of blocking highways. And I think, again, the rebuilding of civil society and the protest movements and of the trade union movement will be part of the effect. I think this will be a learning process for tens of millions of people, and it is a learning process, and this is very important.
Finally, since you have these two movements coalescing, one to the right, one to the left, behind these two candidates, right. If they find right. themselves all in the street, how do you build the unity? Is that possible, given the different ideological narratives, if not the ideology in American politics?
Well, you know, one of the things is ironic is that you have these movements that are not ideologically coherent. The Trump movement does not have a single ideology. And that's, you know, part of the position that Cruz and Rubio are attacking Trump from, that he is a non-interventionist, anti-Israel, liberal, parading as a conservative. Well, the fact of the matter is, what he reflects is not a single ideological stance, as a Cruz or Rubio does, or, in fact, a single set of policies, as, for example, let us say, the Clinton people do. But he represents a movement of the disaffected and the discontented. It's the same thing with Bernie. That's why I don't get hung up in, is he a socialist? Well, what Bernie reflects is the discontent of young people who have no future, of working class people, black, white, Latino, Asian, whose standard of living before, but certainly since the Great Recession, has gone into the toilet, and there is no future of regaining what they previously had, let us say, in the 1990s. So we have movements of discontent rather than movements that are anchored in ideological clarity. Now, of course, for the committed left, this provides a great opportunity, if we are up to the task, of fighting for unity based upon broad ideological concepts such as anti-Wall Street, such as redistributing the wealth and jobs programs, and so on and so forth. I think both camps, that is the Trump camp and the Sanders camp, have more in common than they have differences. And if what I'm saying is correct, we might be entering an era of unprecedented struggle, perhaps going beyond what we even saw in the period of the 1930s. And people who were once voters on the right, or the evangelical right, or the Republican right, or Tea Party members, might be coalescing with people who come out of Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter. This is one of those moments, one of those turning points in the history of this country that we have to be very acutely sensitive to. And I'm very excited about the whole situation, frankly.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.